just after 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and that must mean it's time again for Money Management with Opus 111 Group's Mike Mayle. Here's Mike.
Hello, good morning. Welcome to the latest episode of Money Management. We are your antidote to conventional wisdom. My name is Mike Mayle. I'm with the Opus 111 Group. We're all set for another hour of financial news, a recap on what's been going on in the economic world, and most importantly, how it all affects you. Well, really, this week was a lot of smoke and no fire, in my opinion. We didn't really go anywhere. We've had a couple news items, which we'll discuss here, and today's report will... I want to go over the recession thing where people still think we're in one or about to be in one. We'll talk about the economy, look at some real estate issues. I've been getting a lot of questions about gold with the market being hither and yawning. And we'll also have an outlook of what some folks think is coming in the future here. So yesterday, the Dow ended the week at 34,500. That was up 25 points. The S&P closed at 4,369. The NASDAQ at 13,290. Russell 2000 was at 1,860. Gold settled the week at $1,918 an ounce. Silver at $22.70 an ounce. We had crude ending at $80.66 a barrel. The 10-year at 4.25%. And soft white wheat quoted a little bit higher at $6.91 a bushel. Now, before I get too far into my cogent comments, I want to share with you a quote from the great cowboy philosopher Will Rogers, who had this to offer about investing. He said, and I'm quoting, "Don't gamble. Take all your savings and buy some good stock and hold it till it goes up. Then sell it. If it don't go up, don't buy it." I think that could cover most any circumstance. So there you go. That's how to get rich in the stock market. I think Will had a good idea about that. So, on a more mundane note, the S&P is down overall about 4.9% for the month. Part of that's just, it's a well-deserved rest. The market did have a very nice run earlier in the year, as you know, from March 12th to July 31st. The S&P was up 19%. So this latest dip, though not very significant, has been this slow and steady little drip lower every day. And I think, again, that's a function of it. Summer, a lot of traders are on R&R. I mean, that's just the way it is right now. So try not to read much into the daily carryings on. And this week, we had the shares of J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, Bank America, off about 2%, and that was because this Fitch outfit rating service warned that it may have to, didn't say they will, but may have to downgrade dozens of banks. And last week, as you may recall, Moody's lowered the rating on 10 U.S. banks and putting some on downgrade. So, of course, that had some people all in a tither. It's been having an effect on interest rates. The 10-year Treasury had its highest point since October of last year on Thursday, and it was last trading at 4.28%. Friday, yesterday, it closed at 4.25%, so it's staying pretty much up there. Now, the American Association of Individual Investors do a weekly survey, as we've discussed many times on the program, and these are folks, strangely enough, individual investors, and primarily those folks that are involved in investment clubs, that kind of thing. And it says here that bullish sentiment nosedived in the most recent survey. Only 36% are bullish for the next 6 months, compared with 49% 2 weeks ago. This decline in optimism snapped a 10-week-long streak when bullishness had exceeded the historical average, according to the American Association of Individual Investors. Now, to me, that's just a direct function of news. I mean, why else would people change their spots so quickly for no other reason? I mean, it's certainly not fundamentals. But in any regard, next week going to be pretty slow for economic reports. Again, it's summer. Tuesday, we get the reports on existing home sales, new home sales on Wednesday, and then Thursday, in addition to the jobless claims, we'll be getting the durable goods reports. Now, let me give you a for instance of something that makes absolutely no sense in the market. John Deere. You all remember John Deere. You know, that startup company makes green somethings. Okay. They reported third quarter results that beat expectations. That means was better than. The stock was up 1.6% before the market opened. Now, they earned $10.20 per share on revenue, and this is only in 3 months, of $15.8 billion. They were expecting, the analysts were expecting, $8.20 in revenue, in earnings, and revenue of $14.2 billion. So that's a lot better. So what did the stock do yesterday? Well, of course it was down 22 points to 397. What the heck is that about? I can't even begin to imagine what these traders are thinking other than it's sell on the news, as they say. It ran up so much, we got to take profits. I don't know. But if I were a John Deere shareholder, I would not be looking to open a vein about this. This is strictly trader wackiness. And let's see. Oh, now I want to talk about this recession, so-called recession. You know, the perception that we're in one has persisted, to be polite. And I think one of the best explanations is that not that people are irrationally upset about the economy. It's just that they're using a definition that is somewhat between the two that usually define recessions. That one is where you have two consecutive quarters of GDP negative growth, you get the Sermon from the Mount, also known as the National Bureau of Economic Research, where they have determined in their infinite wisdom that we are in a recession. Well, instead, I think what you might call popular is that the recession, to most people's mind, is simply a definition is the economy stinks. Well, okay. Well, what's caused the stink? The I word, inflation. And even worse, of course, the cost of living had been, operative term had, been rising faster than wages. And on the price of what government officials like to call food at home, now some of us call them groceries, it was going up rather significantly. Now the Fed, at their most recent meeting, and Wednesday we had the notes from that, expressed concern about the pace of inflation and said more rate hikes could be necessary in the future unless conditions change. Well, that discussion during a two-day July meeting resulted in a 0.25% hike that markets generally expect to be the last one of this cycle. However, discussions did show that most members of the Fed board worry that inflation fight is far from over. And the meeting summary stated, and I'm quoting, with inflation still above the committee's longer-run goal and the labor market remaining tight, most participants continue to see significant risks to inflation, which could could require further tightening of monetary policy, unquote. Now, could, again, see, could, maybe. These are not definitive. They're giving themselves wiggle room. Now, the latest increase by the Fed brought their key borrowing level, known as the Fed funds rate, to a range that was between 5.25% and 5%. Now, they say that's the highest level in more than 22 years. And on the surface of it, that's exactly correct. But think back what happened in these 22 years. That's 2001. Okay, so in all that time, the Fed's artificially held interest rates way down most of the period, and they're now just moving back into what, in my experience in my career, has been closer to what normal rates are. Now, anyway, I don't want to get too much into a rant on that, but Scott Granis, who is an economist, says, most people are still captive to the traditional Phillips curve model of inflation. What that means is that in order to tame inflation, the economy has to suffer a significant slowdown in growth. In other words, inflation and unemployment have an inverse relationship where higher inflation is associated with lower unemployment and vice versa. So that would mean the Fed needs to be very tight for a significant period. No easing until early next year. Well, we'll see. We're talking now about the recession kinds of considerations. And, you know, a clear sign of recession for most folks in their own way of looking at the world is that the stuff they need is increasingly priced higher. Well, okay. Food prices have a big effect on how folks experience inflation personally because they look at those things daily, and it can be a large and somewhat inflexible portion of most household budgets because apparently some people like to eat on a regular basis. So, what's changed? Well, one thing, average hourly pay is now growing faster than inflation, this for the first time in 2 years. And in recent months, many Americans are feeling they're no longer feeling behind and are even beginning to catch up, a good trend. And although fewer Americans say we actually are in a recession, the number who say we are is still pretty dang high. And the share saying we're not in a recession is up to 31%. That's up from 26%, only a 5% improvement. Now, the share who say they aren't sure, I'm not sure how you come up with a not sure, but nonetheless, it's up to 25%. So there's been an increase in uncertainty about whether we're even in a recession. That's got to be a tough position. Well, The Economist magazine, the British news magazine, and YouGov survey asked those who said they aren't sure or whether or not we're in a recession if we'll be in 1 6 months from now. Well, back in January, when they did the survey, 4% said a recession very likely, 21% said somewhat. In their most recent poll, 3% said very likely, and 19% somewhat likely. So the share has barely budged? I'm sorry. I just don't get it. But in any case, faster economic growth usually comes with higher long-term interest rates than we've experienced in recent years. As I said, interest rates are just now coming back into what, in my world, was, you know, we had 5, 6, 7% interest for a long time. And interest rates are just one of the multitude of factors that influence valuations. You know, more important, I believe, are changes in investor sentiment. And investors are simply much more optimistic today than they were a decade ago. So pat yourself on the back for such great feeling. Now the economy. There are those hand-wringers, the blues singers, who lament that the economy is running hot. And so, as a result, we're unlikely to see further declines in inflation. Now, the growth of private sector jobs we just talked about has been declining since early 22. The private sector is the one that counts, and jobs there have grown only 2.2% in the past year. That's down from 5% a year ago through July 22. Now, that's up from low numbers because remember how many people weren't working. So you got to look through the numbers, as you usually should, to really see what they're talking about here. Now, over the past 6 months, private sector jobs up 1.6%, and judging by the jobs market, the economy is likely to be growing around 2%. Now, we'll get to another thing here that you'll see that perhaps certain GDP figures don't jibe with that. Now, July's retail sales data came in higher than expected, so that shows stronger than expected consumer spending. Retail sales increased month over month above expectations. And folks, I mean, the if you pardon the term, professional investors are continuing to be blindsided by this resilience in personal consumption growth. According to the Census Bureau, retail sales in July rose to $696 billion. Now, as many news headlines show, that pace was ahead of many economists' forecasts. So the media has been flooded with stories these past 18 months that, quote, consumers are cracking under inflation, unquote. But according to Robert Burgess, executive editor of Bloomberg Opinion, it never happened. U.S. economic data continues to look healthy, and that raises the likelihood that rates will at least stay where they are for the foreseeable future. And that clears a path for risk-on conditions to continue, and for utilities to remain an underperformer. Now, why do I mention utilities? Because as rates go up, or as they're up higher from where they were, you can see that it's had a definite downward push on the price per share of many utilities. Economic growth, pretty sluggish the last 14 years, but that didn't stop inflation from going up. That's because growth has nothing to do with inflation. Okay, write that down. Growth has nothing to do with inflation. Inflation's all about money. So by sharply boosting short-term rates since early last year, the Fed's managed to bring both the money supply and money demand back more into line, and that's why inflation's down. Now, the economic data we've seen so far for this quarter is nothing short of sizzling. Sizzling, he tells you. Industrial production up by 1% in July. Now, that 1%, oh, yippee. But in the greater scheme of things, 1% is quite significant. And that was up from two straight months of declines. Now, here, this is what I was alluding to a second ago. The Atlanta Fed has what they call a GDP Now model. And it forecasts growth in the GDP. And they raised the growth for this quarter, the third quarter of the year, from 4.1% to 5%. And now since then, they've raised it to 5.8%. Why are they doing this? Well, it's not, messing with their medications. It's because the latest upgrade was encouraging data on housing starts and industrial production. Now, M2, which is all the money that's out floating around in our system, has slowed dramatically. Inflation has fallen because interest rates have gone up. See, because higher interest rates make holding money more attractive, and they make borrowing money less attractive. That makes sense. You know, the public is more willing to hold on to, M2 money and less willing to spend it. Public is also less willing to borrow money since interest rates are so relatively high and more willing to pay back existing loans. So the result is a balancing of the supply of money and the demand for money. And again, we're getting this gradual disappearance of inflation. See, growth is the byproduct of savings and investments that boost the productivity of the average perker. That was a cross between person and worker. Perker. The average worker, in addition to the organic growth of the whole workforce. For example, and as an approximation, a 1% increase in productivity plus a 1% increase in jobs increase is a real economic growth of 2%. Hey. So here's the key. It's always the key when it comes to successful investing. Be patient. Sooner or later, the numbers will convince our friends at the Fed that lower rates are called for. In the meantime, continue to enjoy the economy that continues to grow, even slowly, and inflation that continues to decline. That's a good combo. Currently, the market expects the Fed to hold rates steady through the early part of next year and then begin easing. Now, that's going to be data dependent, as the Fed said at their last meeting. But in any case, that's the consensus opinion. Now, the largest declines in costs were for cars, furniture, and electronics stores. Sales at restaurants and bars were up 1.4%, and sales are up 11.9%. So, core sales, which exclude the volatile categories of cars, building materials, and gas stations, are important for estimating GDP, and that rose 1.1%. So higher than the prior months and up 6.2% from a year ago. The trend is our friend, so it would appear. Now, changing gears again, real estate. Now, first thing, I got a question from a fine listener about, he asked if I would address the repayment / refinancing issue for commercial real estate in the U.S., which is coming due by 2025, and were there any possible impacts on us as investors? Well, now that's a pretty high-powered question, I'd say. Somebody's paying attention. Now, CMBS, what is that? Commercial mortgage-backed securities. These are fixed-income investment products that are backed by mortgages on commercial properties rather than residential real estate, you know, like apartments and those kinds of things. We were talking about the effect of the refinancing repayment issue for commercial real estate in 2025. Now, about $1.5 trillion of U.S. This is why the gentleman asked the question, I believe, of U.S. commercial real estate debt comes due for repayment before the end of 2025. So what does that mean? Well, higher interest rates mean higher borrowing costs for property owners who have to refinance those CMBS loans. Those, again, the ones that they use to buy these properties. Those that come due will have to be refinanced at higher interest rates. That means higher payments, even if perhaps vacancy rates rise or remain high. Higher vacancies means some buildings will be worth less, so banks could be less willing to touch them without tougher terms, a.k.a. give me more money. You know, banks own more than half of the agency commercial-backed securities. That is, bonds supported by property loans and issued by U.S. government-sponsored entities such as Fannie Mae. And so that increases their exposure to the sector. The small and regional banks, the biggest source of credit to the industry last year, as you know, have been beat up by deposit outflows following the demise of those West Coast banks, which were not doing banking business, but social engineering business. Anyhow, it raises concerns that it will crimp their ability to finance borrowers. Kevin Fagan, Director of Commercial Real Estate Analysis at Moody's, he had this to say: there's a lot of headaches about calamity in commercial real estate. There likely will be issues, but it's more of a typical down cycle. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. There are reasons to believe lending issues in commercial real estate will be contained, he said. The first is that the office sector is only one part of commercial real estate, and it's a big one. But the others are in, actually unusually good shape. Vacancy rates in the warehouse industrial space nationally are low, this according to Cushman and Wakefield. National retail vacancy rates, despite online shopping, is only 5.7%. Hotels are bringing in record revs per available room because of occupancy and prices being up after the bug, this according to research firm STR. And banks' commercial real estate lending also includes apartment complexes with rental vacancies at 5.8%, and that's according to the feds. So, market conditions are fine today, but what develops over the next 2 to 3 years could be a challenge for some properties. This is Ken Leon, who is an analyst for CFRA. Bottom line, it seems as if most debt coming due in the next 2 years looks as if it can be refinanced. And again, that's assuming that, the worst case always assumes that your interest rates continue to skyrocket. Well, I don't know that I'd buy that argument. So housing starts rose 3.9% to 1.5 million in July. That's according to the Census Bureau, and well above the consensus estimate. And building permits were up as well. So home building continued to look choppy in July. Starts had a moderate gain, and those starts were almost single families. 3 out of 4 regions were up. And if you look at the big picture, during the bug time, a combination of extremely low interest rates, and the pressure to work from home led to a boom in housing in general. Now, when mortgage rates went up, building dropped. Now, the sticker shock of higher mortgage rates is starting to wear off, and we're seeing home building gradually recover to roughly 2019 levels. So, in other words, there is no housing bust. But it's also true that housing is unlikely to be a big contributor to growth in a greater economy sense, with rates higher for longer. Now, many owners of existing homes currently are hesitant to list and sell their properties because they've got, 3 to 4% mortgage rates. So many prospective buyers have to go to new builds. This has supported demand for developers and should help construction activity. And if you look around, the new home builders' shares, the stocks of those companies, are at or close to highs for a very good reason. Now, single-family construction was largely responsible for the decline in activity the past year, and now it's driving the recovery. Number of homes under construction is around the highest level on record going back to 1970. So you're talking about some serious building. Now, these figures also demonstrate a slower construction process due to, no surprise, a lack of workers and still some supply chain issues. And given that the builders already have their hands full, it's not surprising to see permits only up slightly in July. Now, I'm going to talk one thing just as an aside. You know, it's about attitude. I'm a big guy about attitude. It has a lot to do with how you do in the marketplace. And despite the record of things getting better for most people most of the time, pessimism isn't just more common than optimism. It also sounds smarter. Now, it's intellectually captivating and paid more attention to than the optimist, who is often viewed as an obvious sucker, oblivious sucker. Matt Ridley wrote a book in 2010 called The Rational Optimist, How Prosperity Evolves. And I'm quoting from that. He said, if you say the world is going to go on getting better, you are considered embarrassingly mad. If, on the other hand, you say catastrophe is imminent, you may expect either a MacArthur Genius Award or even the Nobel Peace Prize. Now, I should probably be put locked up in a room because I'm way on the positive side. And I'm sorry, but you can't make me get over in that negative end. It's just not accurate or effective. You know, in investing, a bullish voice is almost dismissed as nothing more than a cheerleader. I've been called that lots of times. And while the rumblings of a bear sounds like a sharp mind who has dug past the headlines, now this despite the fact, pay no attention, of course, that the S&P has risen 18,000-fold over the last 100 years, you know, few seem to care about past results when someone else is warning about the next Great Depression. So why is that? I mean, that makes no sense. Here's why I think some reasons why it gets so much attention. Optimism, as I mentioned, appears oblivious to risks. So by default, pessimism looks more intelligent. To the pessimism, how about to the pessimist, a bad event is the whole story. To the optimist, it's just a slow chapter in an otherwise excellent book. Now, pessimism also requires action, whereas optimism means staying the course. Pessimism is sell, get out, run, oh my God, fight or flight, you know, get it right. You're going to die if you don't do something. You know, optimism is mostly, don't worry, stay the course, we'll be okay. Which is easy to ignore since it doesn't require you to do anything. Now, for instance, in 2008, a guy named Lester Brown wrote, by 2030, China would need 98 million barrels of oil a day. The world is currently producing 85 million a day and may never produce much more than that. There go the world's oil reserves. He apparently is a believer in what's called peak oil, so you might want to shunt him to the side. But in any case, he's right, sort of. We would run out of oil in that scenario in 2016, just for relative, to keep it relative to when he was talking. Global production was 97 million, with China's daily usage at 12 million. But that's not how markets work. You know, failing to accept for any type market's ability to adapt is the cause of death of most pessimistic forecasts. Should you ever listen to pessimists? Well, yeah, because they're the best indication of what's unsustainable and thus probably about to change and a basis for something else to be optimistic about. So, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Now, I'm going to get into this gold thing not too deeply, but it's something that keeps coming up. People say, oh, it's uncertain. We should get gold. You know, how much gold should I own? Should I sell all my stocks and get into gold? Well, no. People say society isn't too forgiving these days. But there was a recent Wall Street Journal piece that revealed that some people are quite eager to extend a pardon to gold for reasons best known to them. The article was on August 7th in the Wall Street Journal. It's called When Markets Get Scary, Mom and Pop Buy Gold by Hardika Singh. Now, we're talking about an article that was in the journal recently, August 7th, about gold. And the article explored retail investors' growing fondness for the yellow metal, including some quotes from folks who ditched stocks for gold after seeing the market drop, the stock market drop. Now, those folks were quick to say gold was, oh, it's okay. They absolved them for their penalties for its own downturns because they called it win-win, because that meant they were able to buy at a discount. Interesting thought process. The same behavior that was considered such a deal breaker with stocks has become a purported benefit with gold. Well, isn't that interesting? Now, I don't know why that is, but I think it is, you can find kind of an insight from another sentence in the same article. And I'm quoting, gold, excuse me, gold has been prized for centuries as a store of value by everyone from King Tut to Christopher Columbus. You know, we have seen, unquote, by the way, we have seen this claim so many times in articles and, of course, all the gold ads. The stable store of value is such an appealing phrase, but in our view, it's a meaningless one. We suggest that you don't base investment decisions on empty euphemisms. So what is this? Stable store of value, even just regular store of value, implies something that does move a lot and doesn't lose its worth in the long run. But by that logic, a dollar bill would qualify. Now, if you found a dollar that had a print date of the 80s in your cushions today, you could buy a dollar's worth of today, excuse me, a dollar's worth of something with this, as if you had the same dollar that was just recently printed. But most people wouldn't give the dollar a store of value on her, since you know that the older bill would have bought more like three packs of gum back in the day. Well, a dollar may still be a dollar yesterday, today, and tomorrow, but, and this is important when you're thinking about retirement planning, long-term investing, its purchasing power wanes over time because inflation eats into dollars too much for simple paper money to get the store of value nod. So maybe a store of value is something that doesn't fluctuate much, keep its purchasing power in the long run. Well, that's basically saying it both grows and doesn't lose value. How do you do that? Capital preservation and growth, one of the most ongoing fictions in the entire investing world. No asset can claim to target both at the same time. Growth requires that you take some risk, which requires the possibility of interim declines. But if an investment declines, it has not preserved your capital. It's that simple. So let's put gold under the microscope. If you compare gold's price return when it finally began trading freely, which was in the early 80s, to the consumer price index. Now, a few things here. One, there were long stretches since 1974 when gold was not storing value effectively. Two, it has outpaced consumer prices in only a handful of relatively short bursts in that period. Three, setting aside the whole store of value part, gold was anything but stable. You know, gold's raw price movement, it's all over the place. If you see a big cumulative decline between 1980 and 2000, is that stability? I don't think so. Now, what about that drop in the first half of the tens, which upended everybody who had bought gold as quote-unquote insurance when S&P downgraded the U.S. credit rating? Was gold stable during the global financial crisis or during the stagflationary 70s? No, because even if you had rises, those two make it unstable, you know. So the many riffs on the store of value theme seem to go back to gold's longstanding role in human history and culture. But don't confuse this notion with actual stability and purchasing power on either a nominal or inflation-adjusted basis. Our experience suggests many do just that, with store of value's nebulous meaning masking its actual history. It's an asset that's more volatile than stocks, okay, with lower returns. Oh, yes, I want some of that. Now, whether gold actually stored value for anyone in real life depended entirely on when they bought and sold. And, of course, their definition of the term. Stability, not so much. So, now, the Motley Fool had some comments, too. They said, gold has historically been touted as a safe haven for times of rising inflation and economic uncertainty. But a new study from the National Bureau of Economic Research suggests that, at least since 1990, gold prices have historically declined when real interest rates have risen. You're seeing that now. As rates are going up, you're seeing this gold price continue to drop. As a reminder, real interest rates are simply the stated rate minus the inflation rate. So gold prices actually decline because gold is a non-income generating asset. In other words, the only way you can make money is to sell it for more than what you bought for it. There is no dividends. There's no interest. So when interest rates do go up, the cost of holding the gold, where the gold delivers less value to the holder, it goes up too. So gold prices tend to move in lockstep with demand, not unlike other commodities, which also undermines the potential benefits of using it to hedge rising rates. Now, gold was down to $1,888.50, its lowest level since March 15th, due to these rising rates. So stability is not what it's all about. And again, in full disclosure, I've never suggested that people invest in gold for the reasons you just heard. So that's that. Now, outlook. I'm not in the business of making predictions on short-term moves in the market and economy. Instead, I feel my job position is to provide you with some context so you can get a better understanding of what the heck is driving the market, which may help you understand what will drive it in the future, as well as the economy. Now, almost every month over the past 2 years, measures of personal consumption, like retail sales, have climbed to new record highs. And almost every time, the context has been the same. Job gains and strong consumer finances bolstered by excess savings are fueling spending growth. Well, nothing certain, but maybe we should be optimistic about the consumer outlook since the forces that have been driving spending growth for the past 2 years continue to suggest spending will hold up. With all that in mind, I think it's worth remembering you should beware of what appears to be a lot of alarming business news. Most actual news about the economy and the stock market isn't bad. It's not just the past 2 years have been good in the economy, and similarly, it's not just the past year has been good for stocks. Ben Carlson, a very excellent blogger, recently observed that since 1929, the economy has been in a growth mode 84% of the time. eToro, that's a company, eToro's Callie Cox, noted that since 1950, the stock market has been in a bull market 83% of the time. So I think we can say the stock market usually goes up. That's because earnings go up, a phenomenon supported by the fact that economic activity usually goes up. So, you know, the of course, everyone's experience with news is a little bit different. For example, if you've been following me for a while, then you might have a view of the economy that's more in line with what the data has actually been confirming month after month, as opposed to spinning a little pieces of edges off it and coming to some interesting conclusions otherwise. But if you feel the economic and market headlines seem overly negative, well, it might be time to consider how you're getting your info. Now, in the end, the competition for our attention has never been greater, and it's not going to go away anytime soon, that's for sure. And as we move forward, one of the most important skills you can have will be separating news from noise and ignoring more sensational headlines, especially when it comes to your money. Now, I'm a subscriber to most business news outlets and blogs. They break lots of important news and can provide lots of great info. I just don't think everything they cover actually matters. Now, it's usually the case that my shows and articles have a positive slant. I make no bones about it. This is not because I'm biased, because the news and data actually tends to be positive when covered fairly. History shows that things usually work out positively, and there's little reason to believe it won't continue to be the case in the long run future. Check the record. Well, that's all for this day. I thank you very much for taking the time to listen to me. It means a lot. We'll be back next Saturday with more news and comments about the markets and the economy. I hope you have a tremendously positive week. My name is Mike Mayo. I'm with the Opus 111 Group, and you've been listening to Money Management.
Join us again next Saturday morning at this same time for the financial insight, opinion, and perspective of Money Management with Opus 111's Mike Mayo. Have a question or comment? Email us at info@opus111group.com or visit our website, opus111group.com. Sections of this radio show contain forward-looking statements that are not guarantees of future performance. This information is from sources we believe to be reliable. However, we cannot guarantee that it is accurate or complete. These comments are for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, nor as a recommendation to buy or sell any security or investment product mentioned in this show. Investing involves risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Individual circumstances do vary. Please consult an investment professional prior to making any investment decisions.